This is Susan Livingston reporting for Sequitur for Expressions of Peace Radio. Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. With habitat loss, ecological collapse, and consequent impending extinction as its main themes, Sequitur is a discussion of the natural consequences of actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zymft. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur evolved from the Global Extreme Weather segment on Extinction Radio, which was conceived as a project of the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group on Facebook. Sequitur's purpose is to provide witness to extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life, not just to extreme weather events and natural disasters, and not just when they involve property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. Aho, mitakwe oasin, we are all related. With this show, I'm returning to a theme I've touched on before, the monetization of the necessities of life, namely food, water, shelter, and the land on which those depend. I invite you to consider my words about the struggles of indigenous people across the Americas with their worldview, which holds Pachamama, Mother Gaia, our earthly home, as a sovereign living entity which cannot be owned, cannot be bought and sold, despite the legal gestures and posturing of post-industrial civilization to the contrary. I was taught in public school to ridicule the indigenous tribes of Turtle Island for selling their property to the European imperialists in exchange for beads and shells. Weren't you?
You know, tribes which we can't recreate are where we once learned to relate. Our psychology and stuff we don't understand evolved for that natural state. Simple tribes in which we used to dwell evolved a hate other tribes spell. For a while that worked fine, but now races combine, and it doesn't work out quite as well. We evolved for living in tribes, but civilization prescribes confusions which stem from who's us and who's them, reducing internal good vibes. In tribes, people learned how to deal with each other, but lately we feel disorientation from civilization, and that's why we don't feel so real. A small tribe needs zero execs to establish the order of pecs. When societies rise to a much larger size, the hierarchy's just more complex. We evolved human social foundation within a small tribal formation, but we're socially fluent in ways incongruent with industrial civilization. Life had a much better vibe in old times from what they describe. It's for what we evolved and we now leave unsolved improvement on when we were tribe. Hee-haw!
Before I get into Standing Rock and other occupations, I would join with my Blackfoot friend Running Wolf to remind you that we are all living on occupied land. It takes more than a scrap of fabric or some marks on paper to establish and nurture a relationship between a people and their habitat. It is our ancient assumptions about ownership through conquest, whether by arms or by money, that have unleashed the four horsemen of the apocalypse, whose names in the Christian tradition are pestilence, war, famine, and death. But I'm not going to read to you from the book of Revelation. In light of today's theme, I think the indigenous perspective is more appropriate. So, hear the words of Chief Arval Looking Horse of the Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota nations, and keeper of the sacred white buffalo calf pipe bundle and its teachings since age 12 years, which I've lightly edited for brevity. My words seek to unite the global community. We have been warned from ancient prophecies of these times we live in today, but have also been given a vital message about a solution to turn these terrible times. To understand the depth of this message, you must recognize the importance of sacred sites and realize the interconnectedness of the continued massacres that are occurring on other lands and our own Americas. These places have been violated for centuries and have brought us to the predicament that we are in. Look around you. Our Mother Earth is very ill from these violations, and we are on the brink of destroying the possibility of a healthy and nurturing survival for generations to come, our children's children. Our ancestors have been trying to protect our sacred site, called the Sacred Black Hills of South Dakota, heart of everything that is, from continued violations. Our ancestors never saw a satellite view of this site, but now that those pictures are available, we see that it is in the shape of a heart, and when fast-forwarded, it looks like a heart pumping. The Diné have been protecting Big Mountain, calling it the liver of the earth, and we are suffering and going to suffer more from the extraction of the coal there and the poisoning processes used in doing so. The Aborigines have warned of the contaminating effects of global warming on the coral reefs, which they see as Mother Earth's blood purifier. The indigenous people of the rainforest say that the rainforests are the lungs of the planet and need protection. The Gwich'in Nation in Alaska has had to face oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge coastal plain, also known to the Gwich'in as Where Life Begins. The coastal plain is the birthplace of many life forms of the animal nations. The death of these animal nations will destroy indigenous nations in this territory. As these destructive developments continue all over the world, we will witness much more extinct animal, plant, and human nations because of humankind's misuse of power and their lack of understanding of the balance of life. We are the only species that is destroying the source of life, meaning Mother Earth, in the name of power, mineral resources, and ownership of land. We fail to appreciate and honor our sacred sites, ripping out the minerals and gifts that lay underneath them, as if Mother Earth were simply a resource instead of the source of life itself. These negative developments will cause havoc globally. Our ancestors foretold that water would someday be for sale. This prophecy was hard to believe. The water was plentiful, pure, full of energy, nutrition, and spirit. Today we have to buy clean water, and even then the nutritional minerals have been taken out. It's just clear liquid. Someday, water will be like gold, too expensive to afford. Not everyone will have the right to drink safe water. Allowing continual contamination of our food and land is affecting the way we think. A disease of the mind has set in among world leaders and many members of our global community with their belief that a solution of retaliation and destruction of peoples will bring peace. Attacking nations and using chemicals and methods of warfare that are doing irreversible damage to carry out destruction in the name of peace is not the answer. Mother Earth is becoming tired and cannot sustain any more impacts of war. There are many, many more original teachings and knowledge about Mother Earth's sacred sites, her chakras, and connections to our spirit that will surely affect our future generations. We need to understand the types of minds that are continuing to destroy the spirit of our whole global community. Unless we do this, the powers of destruction will overwhelm us. We need to understand how all these decisions affect the global nation. We will not be immune to its repercussions. In our prophecies, it is told that we are now at the crossroads. Either unite spiritually as a global nation, or be faced with chaos, disasters, diseases, and tears from our relatives' eyes. This new millennium will usher in an age of harmony, or it will bring the end of life as we know it. starvation, war, and toxic waste have been the hallmark of the vast myth of progress and development that ruled the last millennium. Our vision is for the peoples of all continents, regardless of their beliefs in the Creator, to come together as one at their sacred sites, to pray and meditate and commune with one another, thus promoting an energy shift to heal our Mother Earth and achieve a universal consciousness toward attaining peace. I ask you to join me in this endeavor. On your decision depends the fate of the entire world. As each day passes, I ask all nations to begin a global effort and remember to give thanks for the pure food that has been gifted to us by our Mother Earth, so the nutritional energy of medicine can be guided to heal our minds and spirits. To us, as caretakers of the heart of Mother Earth, falls the responsibility of turning back the powers of destruction. You are the one who must decide. You alone, and only you, can make this crucial choice, to walk in honor or to dishonor your relatives. Each of us is put here in this time and this place to personally decide the future of humankind. Did you think the Creator would create unnecessary people in a time of such terrible danger? Know that you are essential to this world. Understand both the blessing and the burden of that. You are desperately needed to save the soul of this world. Did you think you were put here for something less? In a sacred hoop of life, there is no beginning and no ending. Unquote. Aho, amen, and blessed be. I am among those who believe that we are already past the point of no return, over the cliff and in free fall, in a manner of speaking. It is a practice of detachment to outcome for me to follow my conscience anyway, so that the we whose habitat is being destroyed might not include all of life. By many reckonings I respect, population overshoot began long before the Industrial Revolution. With the Agricultural Revolution came a shift of the sacred from the mundane to the ephemeral, and a shift in lifestyle from migratory to sedentary. Thus was born the notion of property ownership, and surplus became possible. Where there is surplus, there is time for art and science to thrive. And where there is surplus, there is also motivation for greed to thrive, as the clever humans compete for control and turn their cooperative instincts to the formation of nation-states with arbitrary boundaries that have nothing to do with sustaining life. Thus was born the polarity between public and private. While the seizing of property and enslavement of conquered peoples reaches back to antiquity, the concept of eminent domain was not formalized until the early 17th century in a treatise by a Dutch jurist. Wikipedia defines eminent domain as the power of a state or a national government to take private property for public use, and points out that the most common uses of property taken by eminent domain are for government buildings and other facilities, public utilities, highways and railroads, or for public safety. However, according to the Legal Dictionary, the power of eminent domain can be legislatively delegated by the state to municipalities, government subdivisions, or even to private persons or corporations when they are authorized by the legislature to exercise the functions of public character. The property may be taken either for government use or by delegation to third parties who will devote it to public or civic use, or in some cases to economic development, which can include such things as a shopping mall, or, in the case of Dakota Access, a corporate-owned pipeline. Economic development, as in increasing tax revenue by creating jobs. So you see the fallacy of the polarity between public and private property. After all, who are the public, if not a collective of private individuals? Rather than rehash a chronology I imagine most of my listeners know better than I do, I'll amplify Nick Burnaby's 5 Things You Need to Know About No DAPL, published on 27 October in Anti-Media, with some of my own research and YouTube viewing. Point one, the Standing Rock Sioux tribe is leading the largest tribal coalition in more than 100 years in their stand against the pipeline. The coalition is also comprised of activists, allies, and environmentalists, collectively known as water protectors, as well as farmers, ranchers, and landowners, many of whom have had their land seized and given to the pipeline via eminent domain. The name of the encampment is the Sacred Stone Camp. It is near the location where the pipeline is planned to cross the Missouri River in North Dakota. The total project crosses four states and runs almost 2,000 kilometers, or 1,200 miles. Point two, the brutal arrest of unarmed water protectors on charges of trespassing on their own land, say what, has precedent in the history of state relations with First Nations people. Yes, Dakota Access LLC, a subsidiary of Energy Transfer Partners, began construction prior to obtaining legal easement from the Corps of Engineers. The Sioux Reservation was created by the federal government in 1851. 11 years later, the federal government forced the Sioux to cede the Black Hills of South Dakota, I said South Dakota, because they wanted to prospect for gold. The Sioux agreed, and the Treaty of Fort Laramie was signed in 1868. See the map at Penina.org on the Sequitur Domain page for clarity on this. Point three. No credible reports of violence by the water protectors have been confirmed or prosecuted. In contrast, private security contractors, bolstered by the North Dakota National Guard, Sheriff's Department personnel from six states, and even British mercenaries, have used attack dogs, armored vehicles, pepper spray, and sound cannons to dislodge the water protectors. Reports of protesters being armed and violent have proven false. Point four. Although the occupation dates back to April, corporate media outlets NBC and ABC refused to cover the story at all for the first several months. As a result of covering No DAPL, dozens of independent media have been arrested, sometimes violently. One filmmaker is facing up to 45 years in prison. Another was tased. One outlet had four of their reporters arrested in one day. They made a big mistake when they arrested Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Attorney Bill Hannigan explained the parallel situation in Iowa in an interview with Goodman on 7 September. 15 landowners, mostly farmers, sued Dakota Access on the basis that, one, it is a private entity, not government, and two, the land is to be used for private profit, not the public good. This is a legal struggle that calls into question the applicability of eminent domain. Dakota Access applied to the Iowa Utilities Board and obtained the power of eminent domain from that board under false pretenses, by claiming that they are a public pipeline that is providing a common carrier service for the benefit of Iowans and the nation. The real story is that the service is for the benefit of corporate wage slaves and shareholders, and the end product is for export, since domestic use of fossil fuel is projected to continue to decline. Point five. Your support is needed in this epic struggle, even if you are not able to travel to Cannonball, South Dakota. For a list of phone numbers you can call to express your support and links to use to donate money or materials, see the domain page at Penina.org. There were even postal mail campaigns posted as Facebook events to flood the deciders, including the bank financers of the $2.3 billion project. How glad I am that I copy-pasted those addresses to my web page before the Facebook event pages mysteriously disappeared. Say what? The next day, my brother Steve Stereo Man Livingston wrote the following Facebook status. I'm seeing a lot of similarities being claimed between the current occupation at Standing Rock and the occupation last winter of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge. Here are five comparisons around which I see more contrast than equivalence. 1. Whose property is it? In both cases, the occupation involves federal land, but while the Bundy clan had no legal claim whatsoever on the Malheur facility, the Native Americans have legitimate claims to Standing Rock, moral, ethical, and legal. 2. How has law enforcement responded to the occupations? I would say kid gloves versus jackboots. 3. How have the media responded to the occupations? It seemed to me that every minor detail of the Malheur occupation was broadcast widely in the mainstream media, and every word spoken by the occupiers was lifted up and presented as newsworthy. The contrast with the current occupation could not be more stark. 4. What purpose was being served? What goal was set forth to be accomplished by the occupations? I would say sacred versus profane. 5. And lastly, is there one overarching stark contrast between the two events that could even begin to explain these vast differences? If it looks like a duck, sounds like a duck, and walks like a duck, it makes sense to first assume it is a duck, and then see if there is any evidence to the contrary. This duck is called white supremacy. End quote. Thank you, Steve, for naming the racial component of the issue. The map I posted on the Panina blog page also makes this clear, with the contrast between the originally planned route of the Black Snake that was successfully protested by the white-dominated population that would be impacted when, not if, the pipeline leaked or got sabotaged or was abandoned, and the new route that instead crosses unceded Sioux territory. Another contrast that was pointed out by one of your commenters, and I'm reframing it here to remove the element of judgment, is that both sides of the Malheur occupation were armed to the teeth, while the Standing Rock Sioux are an unarmed, prayerful assembly faced with a paramilitary deployment. By way of observation and with no judgment intended, I would also say that no DAPL is locally led, while the Bundy Bunch were themselves colonizers. However, in their defense, I would say that the occupation of the Malheur property was a protest against the same kind of exclusive property ownership that I felt in Oakland, California during Occupy, when I saw homeless people sleeping in Oscar Grant Plaza, where huge government buildings with full toilet and cooking amenities stood vacant for at least 12 hours each day and 2 full days each week, and under strict guard 24/7, while the city claimed it didn't have the money to build more shelters or hire people to staff them. Yes, it's true that, like the Bundy Bunch, those homeless people had no legitimate claim to the space in those buildings, just a need for a surplus resource. Meanwhile, neighboring Berkeley built downtown parking structures instead of closing the streets in this eminently walkable downtown to the too dense personal vehicular traffic of able-bodied UC Berkeley students and building shelters. Can you say tax revenue? But back to the Bundy Bunch. In some sense, they were atavists simply following their herds to seasonal pastures. Isn't it interesting that our culture wants the meat that is the fruit of their labor, but only at a low price, and only if the ranchers pay for grazing rights so that the animals can eat the forage the authorities had nothing to do with producing? As Chief Looking Horse reminds us, food is the gift of the mother, freely given. Public or private, when did mine become the equivalent of mine but not yours? Instead of mine first and help yourself when I'm done. Another interesting series of comments to Steve's post was prompted by a friend pointing a finger at, quote, big oil and the billions of dollars lining their pockets, unquote. Steve responded, quote, as soon as you start talking about big oil, it's time to start talking about our complicity arising from our use of their products, and the glee with which we celebrate when the cost goes down, unquote. Another friend replied, my comfort from low pump prices is engineered by the oil cartel, unquote. To that, I would respond with the recommendations given by Arundhati Roy of the World Tribunal on Iraq, boycott, divest, walk out. Take a page from Running Wolf's book and stop driving global warming.
You know, those bastards who are spoiling the soil, they really make my blood boil. I'd tear out their guts and cut off their nuts, except that I still want the oil. Hee-haw!
It wasn't until I kicked the habit 5.5 years ago that I realized how addicted I was. Not to oil, the precious secretion of Mother Earth, which is quite frankly nasty stuff, or even to the personal automobile per se, which is just another consumer good, but rather to the convenience of owning an on-demand personal mobility device, aka private passenger vehicle. It's the hardest habit I've ever broken, and it's also the best lifestyle decision I've ever made. I'm eternally grateful that I did it as a conscious choice rather than waiting until I was compelled by physical or financial necessity. As a culture of wage slaves, it is of course more complicated for most people. Even the most highly principled people have student loans and home mortgages. And if there's a family at stake, then the banksters must be appeased.
The destination of this train is Braintree.
We interrupt this podcast to bring you an update on Guy McPherson's upcoming New Zealand tour. This will be the last full update since the tour begins before the next Sequitur podcast. So again, I'll list the details for all 10 now of the presentations. And again, if you want to see it in writing, go to Facebook, type Guy McPherson in the search bar, and select Professor Guy McPherson's Abrupt Climate Change Tour New Zealand 2016. Guy's name is spelled McPherson. Thursday, 24 November, Gratitude Day in the USA, an interview on The Paul Henry Show on TV3, 6 to 9 a.m. Friday, 25 November, Cowrie Room, Far North REAP, Pukey Avenue, Kaitaia, 6 p.m. Saturday, 26 November, In Step Dance Studio, 42 Rayburn House Lane, Whangarei. Sunday, 27 November, Keynote at Unitech Campus, Point Chevalier, Auckland, in the Gold Lecture Theater, 3 p.m. New Zealand time, 2 a.m. UTC GMC. In North America, that's Saturday, 26 November, at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Kevin Hester, Guy McPherson's New Zealand host, says there will be technical support for live stream technology for this event, so I look forward to being there even though I can't be there. Stay tuned to the event page for connection information. Monday, 28 November, Events Room 1, Bill Gallagher Center, WinTech Campus, Waikato, 6 p.m. Wednesday, 30 November, public meeting at the Mangarara Eco Lodge, Patangata Autain, 6:30 p.m. Thursday, 1 December, presentation followed by Q&A and meet and greet at the Davis Lecture Theater, Whanganui Regional Museum, 6 p.m. Saturday, 3 December, Renwick Anglican Church Hall, Nelson Region, 3 p.m. Monday, 5 December, Stop Out Soccer Club, Hutt Park, Gracefield, Lower Hutt, 6 p.m. Tuesday, 6 December, GBLT1, Victoria Law School, Wellington, 6 p.m. Wednesday, 7 December, The Atrium, Hagley Park Netball Courts, Christchurch, 7 p.m. You are listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart, archived at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. Breaking news! According to a report by Ivan Stiv in Countercurrent News, authorities returning from deployment to Standing Rock are starting to speak out about the injustice of using riot control tactics against unarmed, prayerful people. Minnesota's Hennepin County sheriffs are refusing redeployment, and the lieutenant governor and state lawmakers found the actions of the officers inappropriate and are seeking legislative action to avoid becoming involved in similar situations going forward. Wisconsin's Dane County Sheriff's Department went a step further. They pulled out and refused to return. Sheriff Dave Mahoney said that a wide cross-section of the community, quote, share the opinion that our deputies should not be involved in this situation, unquote. An alderwoman from Madison, Wisconsin, who was in Standing Rock as a legal observer, was arrested on riot charges while filming and attending a prayer meeting. The Countercurrent report further alleges that Amy Goodman's team filmed dog attacks by pipeline security contractors who lacked proper canine licenses. Kudos to Wisconsin. Write to them and congratulate them on their integrity. Let them know that the eyes of the world are upon them and that we see their courage. I believe such visibility will tip the balance for their brothers and sisters who are only beginning to question their actions in compliance with the orders of their handlers. The announcement came in the wake of the arrival of an Earth Citizen mentor of mine called Pancho Ramos of the Canticle Farm community in Oakland, California. He had written in his blog that two officers had turned in their badges in response to the unethical role they were being ordered to play on behalf of the pipeline, and this was corroborated by Stiv's report in Countercurrent. I traced the story back to a report early last weekend by Red Hawk. Quote, there have been at least two reports of police officers turning in their badges, acknowledging that this battle is not what they signed up for. You can see it in some of them, that they do not support the police actions. We must keep reminding them that they are welcome to put down their weapons and badge and take a stand against this pipeline as well. Some are waking up. Close quote. And that's where I'm reminded of Pancho's energy when, undocumented and unafraid, he told an immigration officer who had him in custody that her soul was too beautiful to dishonor with such work. So I can't help wondering if it was Pancho's arrival at Standing Rock that tipped the balance in favor of the Sioux resistance. So thank you, Pancho. He is co-founder of Service Space and blogs at earthlingopinion.wordpress.com. The other indigenous water protectors who are dear to my heart are the Pachamama Alliance, whose 20th anniversary was celebrated at a dinner at Fort Mason in San Francisco last Thursday night by a few hundred people around the world via live stream, and by me here in Asheville, North Carolina on Friday afternoon. I was painfully reminded by my low turnout that my event organizing days are over. I just don't have the energy anymore, especially for promotion, but even for hosting, although I do still enjoy creating and distributing a beautiful flyer. The original call to action 20 years ago was from the Achuar Nation. For more than a decade, their shamans had been having dreams about a terrible threat from the Northland, but resource extraction and commodification were so foreign to their lifestyle and worldview that it took them some time to figure out the source and nature of the threat. Then the hunters started hearing foreign sounds in the jungle and noticing evidence of small-scale spill damage and the waste stream of industrialized humans, and they figured it out. But their wisdom tradition teaches them not to avoid danger, but to walk toward it. So began what they called the reverse missionary work of awakening the global north from its collective trance. John Perkins and Lynn and Bill Twist heard the call in a profound way and founded the Pachamama Alliance. The Achuar were subsequently joined by the Shuar, Shiwiar, Sapara, and Kichwa nations. The mission of the Pachamama Alliance is to empower indigenous people of the Amazon rainforest to preserve their lands and culture, and using insights gained from that work, to educate and inspire individuals everywhere to bring forth a thriving, just, and sustainable world. I actually like the way that last bit was expressed 3 years ago when I attended my first Awakening the Dreamer, Changing the Dream symposium. To bring forth an environmentally sustainable, socially just, and spiritually fulfilling human presence on this planet. Despite the fact that I don't believe in justice, dependent as it has become on the static rule of law rather than on dynamic community process, this latter statement has an element of humility that to my ears is lacking in the revised mission statement. At the gathering Thursday night were two Indigenous presidents and a vice president, as well as a Peruvian and Lakota ceremonial leader. It was a bit bizarre for me to hear some of the Indigenous presenters speaking Spanish, the language of the historical oppressor, so I was surprised at the relief I felt at hearing the accented or even broken English of some of the others. I was most at ease when they spoke their tribal language and showed the English translation as subtitles. In contrast to the patriarchal flavor of the colonial Latino cultures, the Indigenous people understand the importance of improving the life, health, and literacy of the women, as illustrated by their Jungle Mamas program. To tie all this back to my theme, note that these folks don't much care if they're on the Peru side or the Ecuador side of the line on the map, but they've had more success in negotiations with the nation-state of Ecuador than that of Peru on two fronts. One is the mapping project, in connection with which they have been successful in obtaining legal title to their land, for whatever that's worth. Subdividing parcels rather than holding the land as a common good has been a divisive force in their social structure, as it has been in ours. The difference is the strong sense of connection both with community and with the earth that is so obvious in Indigenous cultures there and so obviously absent in post-industrial cultures. The other front is that Ecuador was the first nation state to establish laws to give nature a voice in the land use decision-making process. I'm reminded here of the governance model in Starhawk's post-apocalyptic ecotopian novel, The Fifth Sacred Thing, where nature has four voices, one for each of the four directions, embodied by four people wearing masks representing the animal characteristic of each direction, the masculine east represented by eagle, the feminine west represented by bear, the physical south represented by rabbit, and the spiritual north represented by buffalo. These are not elected offices or paid positions. Rather, members of the community rotate the honor and privilege of embodying these voices. So economic gain, whether public or private, is not adequate grounds for assault on non-human communities. However, none of this is to say that eminent domain cannot be invoked, or even that in these days of instantaneous mass communication, the people are willing to watch their neighbors enjoy a softer lifestyle than they ever dreamed possible. Just as post-industrial people long for that indigenous sense of place and community, so do indigenous people long for cell phones and flush toilets. And as long as property is commodified and patriarchy is in place in an ever more globalized world, there will be one or a few who have the authority to make decisions that affect everyone. The 8 million acres of pristine, roadless rainforest protected by the Pachamama Alliance are of immense ecological significance, not only for their biodiversity. Every second breath you take comes to you courtesy of the rainforest. And as the headwaters of the Amazon basin, this region is the largest source of fresh water in the world. It is a priceless treasure that has been threatened more than once with monetization by the Ecuadorian government, who would exercise the by now familiar concept of eminent domain to sell resource exploration and extraction rights to foreign oil companies, whether from Argentina, the U.S., or more recently, China. And who can blame one of the poorest countries in the world for wanting to occupy a more competitive position in the global marketplace. Yet by what right does the fiction of a national government decide the fate of the homeland of people who have lived in harmony with the living community for thousands of years? At home in the USA, the work of the Pachamama Alliance to change the dream of the post-industrial world has centered on two political issues. One is the move to amend, to pass a constitutional amendment that would reverse Citizens United, the court decision that confirmed the rights of corporate entities to negotiate with indigenous people and enter into binding agreements with them. Say what? Do I hear an echo of the doctrine of manifest destiny that holds financial profit above the needs of the living communities and non-living systems that support them? To me, it seems silly to call this corporate personhood, for when people engage in the same activities, it is called vandalism or trespassing, not development. The other legal campaign is the implementation of a carbon tax, which many believe is a necessary measure to stimulate the move from dependence on fossil fuels to exploration of less extractive sources of energy. I could do another whole show on why these campaigns seem like busy work to me, but I have too much respect for the work on the ground in Ecuador to discount the domestic agenda. In Ecuador, the efforts are in the direction of ecotourism, but without the air conditioning and bottled water that has characterized such efforts elsewhere on the planet. These journey programs offer a unique opportunity for the urbanized to go native and experience connection with our planetary home, perhaps a last chance to fall in love with our living Mother Earth. How many times have I heard people say, "But I don't need a symposium or a journey to awaken me. I'm already awake. I'm a member of the Sierra Club. I eat a vegan diet, recycle my waste, vote with my dollars, drive a Prius." All of these are examples of gestures that we of the post-industrial world make to honor our integrity because it's the best we can do. But these gestures can't hope to mitigate the effects of the matrix civilization into which we were born. From the perspective of that matrix, limited to temporary relationships with places such as our backyard or the designated hiking trail, or with plants and animals who are owned, our love of nature is like our love of a cultural icon or a historical hero. People return from these journeys completely transformed, just as the astronauts are transformed by their view of the Earth from space. It's an intimate, visceral experience. They may have thought they were awake. They may have been among the self-righteous who say that they don't need awakening. But there is no substitute for first-hand experience. Just viewing the video teaser reduces me to tears of nostalgia for our loss as a human species and regret that I will not have the opportunity to participate in such a journey. My journey work continues to be an inner experience through my studies in shamanism. I can hardly imagine what it must be for these indigenous people to live in total immersion in a shamanic lifestyle. Even calling it a lifestyle feels somewhat superficial, since it's not a matter of choice or trends for them, but rather the only way of life they have ever known. These are some of the last remaining dream weavers on Earth. They have no alarm clocks or bosses, but they're up before the sun every day, and they meet in sacred circle before they break their fast or do any other work or activity to capture the knowledge and intuitions that have come to them from the dreams and visions of the night. They need no teachers. They have elders for that work. At any rate, the video of the 20th anniversary gathering is available at Pachamama.org. That's PachaMama.org. Either as a continuous play 2.25-hour video or as a series of much briefer clips. I hope this little teaser on Sequitur has moved you to investigate further and consider making a donation before the end of the calendar year so that you can get in on the matching funds program underwritten by generous sponsors. Don't wait until the next round of negotiations with the next potential buyer for the next piece of virgin rainforest. We mustn't let our activism become crisis-driven, the way our so-called healthcare system is. Full details about how you can engage are on the Pachamama website. So it looks like I've got time for a climate change update. I promised myself I would lay off that research because too much detailed information paralyzes me with grief and fear and even makes me physically ill. So I've extracted a Guy McPherson segment from last week's Nature Bats Last. The complete show is available at prn.fm. So what have you been up to, Guy?
I watched Leonardo DiCaprio's documentary film, Before the Flood. Apparently he hasn't noticed the flood is already here. Among the people DiCaprio interviewed on camera was Jason Box, climate scientist from Denmark. That conversation took place in Greenland. Box pointed out that Greenland's ice has melted to the tune of 30 feet in the last 5 years. Kind of a big deal. This is the same Jason Box who said he'd be interviewed on this very radio program if and only if I would admit my straw bale house is fixing climate change. The straw bale house has been here since 2008, and yet 30 feet of ice disappeared from Greenland since 2011. Apparently the straw bale house didn't fix climate change after all. If only it were so easy. Get into some of the headlines. This from the New York Times. Living in China's expanding deserts, we dread the sandstorms. From the Associated Press, at ground zero of Alabama's drought, it's an agricultural disaster. And the hits keep coming. You know, this is from Bloomberg yesterday. Long the talk of conspiracy theorists, geoengineering schemes move closer to reality. The United Nations body is investigating controversial methods to avert runaway climate change by giving humans the go-ahead to re-engineer the Earth's oceans and atmosphere. Well, the National Academy of Sciences of the United States and an equivalent body in Europe within the last 2 years have both concluded that geoengineering is likely to make things worse, not better. But we're desperate. And so this is another headline from Bloomberg. Again, just yesterday, climate change is already forcing Americans to move. That's from Bloomberg. This is not some extreme liberal left-wing source. We're talking about Bloomberg here admitting that Americans are being forced to move because of climate change, that we have climate change refugees, and they're not just in the Middle East, and they're not just in Northern Africa, and they're not just in the Southern Pacific and island states that are being overwhelmed by storm surges. They're happening here. Here, even in the land of American exceptionalism, where only exceptional people live, here people are being forced to move as a result of climate change. So, yeah, I strongly suspect we're in the early stages of abrupt climate change and that habitat for humans will end everywhere on the planet in the not-too-distant future. I think that the class rate gun fired in 2007, that's methane leaking out of the Arctic Ocean at an accelerating rate. It appears to me that happened in 2007. People tell me all the time, no, you can't really tell that happened. You can't tell that the class rate gun was fired for 10 years afterward. We need 10 years worth of data. Well, okay, we're at 9, and I'm willing to stick my neck out and say that we are experiencing atmospheric methane going exponential in the atmosphere. Yes, I agree that these tipping points have been crossed already. Some of them quite a while ago, and so the time to make significant changes in the way we live is long behind us. I'm going to read some headlines and give some sources. All of these have appeared within the last week. Headline from the Science Explorer, researchers say efforts to curb climate change will likely fail. Yes, apparently we're past the point of no return, folks. According to Carbon Brief, a very conservative source, climate change could push risk of mega drought to 99% in American Southwest. I think that's being conservative, but what do I know? 99, maybe that's good enough for everybody else. Then we think we're going to be the ones who escape, right? Everybody else is going to die, but not me. New York Times poses the question by a headline, where should you live to escape climate change? Well, if you live in the Middle East or Northern Africa, if you live on one of the small island states in the South Pacific, if you live in many places in the United States, it's a little late to escape climate change. You've already tried to run away. I promise that in the very near future, nobody will escape abrupt climate change. Notice that word doesn't appear very often, abrupt, in headlines in the mainstream outlets. Also within the last week, this from Bloomberg, I've quoted a couple of their headlines already. This, again, is a business-based publication, Bloomberg.com. Here's the headline, Magical Thinking Won't Stop Climate Change. Oh, magical thinking won't stop climate change. Well, that's kind of a bummer, because I thought that's all we had at this point was magical thinking, and now you're telling me that won't even work. So according to Inside Climate News, rapidly warming Mediterranean is headed for desertification, according to a recent study. Also from Inside Climate News, warming triggers early algae blooms with potential ripple effects to come. Yeah. Mm-hmm. According to Scientific American, here's the headline, dreaded polar vortex may be shifting. And I've come to believe that anytime there's a maybe or a would or a could in the headline, what it really means is it's already happening. So all this stuff is already underway. We just don't want to admit it to ourselves.
I agree with you that we're past the point of no return. But when I really connect with the fact that any remedial efforts we make are too little too late, and at best a privileged self-indulgence, I don't know what to do with the helpless despair that I feel. I don't admit this to most people, but I know I can bring it to you without risking censure for negativity or a compulsory dose of hopium in the form of the latest techno fix. Where can I find the motivation to get out of bed in the morning?
At the edge of extinction, only love remains, and we're there. We are at the edge of extinction. And so let's go down with love. Let's go down demonstrating the kinds of values in our behavior that we claim to hold dear. We're going down, folks. How are we going to act on the way? Are we going to demonstrate the best of humanity, or are we going to demonstrate the worst of humanity on our way out the door? Let's not leave the movie early. Let's hang in for the whole show. And in addition, let's act like the best human beings we can be to other human beings and to the rest of the living planet as well. I'm going to move on and talk about a climate change update that is from way back in July. We've long believed the extinction of dinosaurs about 66 million years ago was driven by an asteroid striking the Yucatan Peninsula. A paper in the July 14, 2016 issue of Scientific Reports adds to the story. Turns out the asteroid struck an oil-rich area, and the attendant release of soot from burning oil caused the skies to darken and therefore create sufficient cooling that the dinosaurs were unable to survive. It wasn't just the asteroid. It wasn't just the asteroid kicking up a bunch of dust. It was the asteroid lighting an oil-rich area, sparking it, and causing the burning oil to release soot that caused the skies to darken. That caused the extinction. The asteroid striking oil caused the extinction of the dominant life form on the planet. In not so sharp contrast, we struck oil and triggered a massive warming event leading to human extinction. We are the asteroid that struck the oil. We are the dinosaurs that died as a result.
We are the asteroid and we are the dinosaurs. Aho! Thanks for that, Guy. We'll have to sit with that for a while. That sure does bring We Are One to a whole new level. Meanwhile, thanks for listening to Sequitur, a podcast of expressions of peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart, archived at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. And special thanks to contributors Benjamin the Donkey, Steve Livingston, Guy McPherson, Kevin Hester, the Pachamama Alliance for information on how to support the water protectors of the Amazon rainforest, Carl Sack and the Huffington Post for the Dakota Access map on the domain post at panina.org, Nick Burnaby of Anti-Media, Jay Sermopoulos of the Free Thought Project, my WordPress mentor, author Susan Terry, for information about how to support the water protectors at Standing Rock, and to Zimft for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
What connects us is one.